This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. This is the virtual space where a big current topic gets together with you, me and the top experts for 28 minutes. This week, torrential downpours, floods, forest fires and preparations for a giant climate conference. What on earth is going on? We've got off-the-scale record temperatures in North America and huge wildfires. The same in Siberia. 100-year weather events causing fatal floods in Europe and China. And news that the Amazon is now emitting more carbon dioxide than it absorbs. The effects of man-made climate change are moving from future threats to present reality. In November, the biggest ever gathering of world leaders on British soil is due to take place in Glasgow, known as COP26. Will it help save us from extreme climate change? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's begin with a definition, and bear with me. COP26 is the 26th conference of the participants to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was first agreed in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. So beyond that, what is this meeting in Glasgow about? To help answer that, I'm joined in the briefing room by Elena Avachenkova, a distinguished fellow from the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at the London School of Economics. Elena Avachenkova, what is COP26 about?
This session of international negotiations is a very important one. It's a conference about ambition. So in 2015, when Paris Agreement was adopted, countries recognized that the ambition committed at the time was not enough to address dangerous climate change. And there would need to be every 5 years a cycle of new commitments and assessment of how well we're doing. And that assessment was meant to be last year, but it was postponed because of the global pandemic.
If you could remind us what the agreement was with regard to temperatures at Paris in 2015.
The Paris Agreement was guided by the latest available scientific information, and that is that we need to keep temperature increase to 2 degrees Celsius and to do our best efforts to keep the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees in order to avoid catastrophic impacts of climate change. Unfortunately, the pledges committed under the Paris Agreement in 2015 would put us on a path of about 3 degrees temperature increase still. So we definitely need more efforts and great ambition. And if we look at what the world was at the time, the temperature was 3 degrees higher than today. It was about 3 million years ago. And at the time, the sea level was about 10 to 20 meters higher than today. So we can just imagine this will be a drastically different world if we actually allow temperature to rise by 3 degrees. So it's really important that countries step up their ambition, increase their emission reduction pledges, so we can actually get to the international trajectory of keeping global warming to 2 degrees and actually have a chance to keep global warming to 1.5 degrees.
So essentially, this isn't just a routine COP. This is one of those 5 yearly COPs where you really do quite a lot of work looking back at what you've achieved and what you've still to do.
Yes, absolutely. It is about looking at progress made today. It is about countries putting on the table new pledges to reduce emissions. And it's not just about the 2 weeks of the negotiations. A lot of work goes around the year leading to that. And the United Kingdom, the government is leading on that. So we already have a few countries which have put on the table new pledges to reduce their emissions and also to bring them to net zero. For example, the European European Union has recently adopted a very ambitious law at the level of the whole bloc, which commits EU to net zero or to climate neutrality by 2050, and also revises their emission reduction target for 2030 to more ambitious levels. Similarly, China, President Xi has made an announcement that China will become net zero by the year 2060. However, they haven't yet submitted a new pledge under the Paris Agreement. So these are just some examples of the big players where new commitments I expected ahead of Glasgow.
What about the smaller countries?
The smaller countries play absolutely essential role in international climate negotiations. Many small, vulnerable developing countries, they are the ones who will suffer most from the impacts of climate change, and they also need assistance to cope with climate change. Historically, they played a leading role in pushing for more ambitious action internationally. Now, I'll give you an example. Leading up to the negotiations of the Paris Agreement, there was an international coalition formed. And the country that is leading this coalition is Marshall Island, a small island state. Other countries which are members are Fiji, Costa Rica, also small and highly vulnerable countries. And it's widely recognized that the efforts of this coalition were instrumental in actually getting the Paris Agreement to acknowledge the importance of reducing temperature, keeping it to 1.5 degrees, and also to reducing emissions globally to net zero levels.
So we have the big countries, we have the smaller countries, and I presume we have a lot of non-governmental organizations, etc., also attending on the fringes.
Non-governmental organizations are key to the negotiating process. So if we look at the Paris summit, there were about 40,000 people reported to attend the Paris climate summit. And it's not just, as you say, government negotiators, it's non-governmental civil society activists, youth activists, private sector. And what they do is they put pressure on governments. They also discuss and exchange experiences on what works, what are the challenges in implementing climate change actions. Cities, the governors of regions come together as well, parliamentarians. So really, the climate negotiations, they galvanize this dialogue throughout the whole of society from different regions and countries to learn about how can we be more successful in reducing emissions and also adapting to the impacts of climate change.
Alina Avichenkova, let's look a bit more closely at the promises and commitments already made on limiting climate change and where they've left us. In the briefing room now is Michael Jacobs, professor at Sheffield University's Political Economy Research Institute, and between 2004 and 2010, he was special advisor to the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, with responsibility for energy, climate change and environment policy. Michael Jacobs, what do you see as the main challenges facing the Glasgow summit?
There are two big challenges which this summit has to address. The first of them is what is often called the emissions gap. The problem with Paris, good agreement though it was that there is a big gap between the overall goal, the global goal, which countries committed to, that is holding global heating to 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels, and the actual commitments they have each made as individual nations to cut their own emissions. That gap is large.
Can you quantify that gap at all?
So the scientists say that to be on a trajectory to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels, in 2030, global emissions need to be around 25 gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalent. That's the unit that they use. We are currently expected to be at 53 to 56 gigatons by 2030. Given the commitments that countries have made.
So let me get this absolutely clear. If all the promises that have been made were fulfilled, we still wouldn't be anything like in the ballpark of keeping warming within 1.5 degrees.
That's correct. We would still be way off.
So is one of the challenges taken on by the Glasgow summit actually getting people to go beyond the promises they've already made?
In principle, yes, that's precisely what this meeting is for. The problem is that countries don't actually make their commitments at the conference. They announce them in advance. And many of the largest countries, including the EU, the UK, the US, have now already announced their new commitments for 2030. So we already know that this summit will not get close to the commitments that countries collectively have agreed to make.
OK, well, that's not very reassuring. And are there countries who actually simply have not fulfilled the promises they've made, inadequate though those promises were?
The commitments that countries made in Paris were also for 2025 or 2030. So we cannot yet say that countries have not yet met their existing promises. Unfortunately, many countries look off track to meet them, including, it has to be said, the United Kingdom, which is not on track to meet its commitments for 2030, but has now said it will, in fact, increase those commitments. And some, such as Brazil, which has allowed a huge increase in deforestation under its president, Bolsonaro, some are going backwards.
Now, what about China in all this? World's largest economy, world's biggest polluter.
China poses a huge challenge, and primarily to itself. China will probably be the country in the world most affected by climate change. If the glaciers in the Himalayas melt, China has no water. So China is very well aware that this is about self-preservation. And of course, it's also trying desperately to cut air pollution in its cities, which also arise from the use of fossil fuels. So this is not something China is doing for the rest of the world. China is doing this for itself and has taken huge strides to reduce its emissions over the levels they would have been otherwise. But because China is still a growing economy, it still has many people who live in poverty, its emissions have not yet reached the peak of their curve in the way that most developed countries have already hit their peak and are now on the way down, though not fast enough. But the scale of China's economy means that we are all in many ways dependent on the action it takes.
Now, what about what people call the finance gap? Can you explain that one to me?
Yes, in 2009... at the Copenhagen COP, the developed countries, the rich countries, agreed to achieve a transfer of finance from rich to poor countries of $100 billion a year by 2020. But the latest figures suggest that that $100 billion commitment has not been reached. The last figures we have for this are 2018, and the amount that was being transferred from rich to poor countries was just under 80 billion. We don't have the figures for 2020 yet, but unfortunately, nobody believes that that promise of 100 billion will have been met. And for many developing countries, this is really a matter of trust. If the developed world makes a promise and then doesn't keep it, the developing countries ask, well, what use are your future promises? And many of them are now suffering really damaging effects of climate change that's occurring now, and they would like money to help them tackle it. It's the poorest countries, some of them very low-lying and literally existentially threatened by rising sea levels, which are bearing the brunt of climate impacts.
People talk a lot in this field about mitigation and about adaptation. Can you take me through what those mean?
There are two kinds of actions that all countries need to take to tackle climate change. One is to prevent future climate change by reducing our emissions of greenhouse gases, absolutely for the developed countries and for the developing ones as much as possible, given that they are still growing. The second type of action we need to take is to cope with the climate change that we are already experiencing. And that's the phrase adaptation. So reducing your emissions is mitigation. Coping with the climate change you're already facing is adaptation. And what adaptation means are things like stronger flood defences and sea wall defences, using new crops which are more resistant to drought to cope with the climate change that's already happening.
Does the COP just discuss mitigation, or does it also discuss adaptation?
It discusses both. And for developing countries, the issue today is adaptation. They're already experiencing climate change. Their own emissions are often very small, so they haven't got a lot of mitigation that they can do or frankly need to do, but they do need to adapt and they need money and help to adapt. So there is a big question about whether adaptation will be given, if you like, parity of esteem alongside mitigation at the COP.
Michael Jacobs. The question of climate change and meeting targets often sounds like an abstract process. Are there more useful ways of thinking about them? I'm joined in the briefing room by Professor Carly McLachlan from Manchester University, where she's also the director of the Manchester branch of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research.
Professor McLachlan, how useful do you think temperature targets like 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees are in helping to tackle climate change?
So I think they're super important. It's how we understand climate change. It links to the calculations around the impacts that we will have to adapt to. But I also think it's sort of taking more of a dashboard approach, if you like. So one side of looking just at 1.5 or 2 degrees, I think it potentially masks, by being an average of global temperature rise, the more extremes that actually we would face if we did hit that average level. Instead of thinking about an average of 2 degrees increase, think rather about the hottest places on the hottest days getting an additional 4 degrees on the top of that, and more frequent extreme events and things like that. So I think it's important that we talk about that. 2 degrees can, in our context in the UK, sound like not that big a deal, but actually the particular impacts that that would align with would have serious repercussions. The other side of it is that what we really need to get on with is actually reducing our emissions. So we need to be talking about what level of emissions reduction are we going to be making and how quickly are we doing that. So those temperature targets of 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees are linked to global carbon budgets. So that's the total amount of carbon that you can emit to be in line with achieving those targets in the Paris Agreement. Now, budget's a good term there, I think, because if we think about that, if you spend your budget too quickly, it's all gone and our chances are much reduced of hitting those targets. I think we need to be thinking about carbon budgets, about getting our emissions down so that we can spread that budget over longer. But also we need to be thinking about more focused impacts and not just that average change.
To be absolutely clear, the implication of trying to get temperature rises within those limits is that everybody effectively has a carbon budget, how much carbon they can spend in order to get us to that level across the world. And that may differ from country to country, but nevertheless, every country would, should, could have a carbon budget.
There's different levels of responsibility for the emissions we've already had, and then there's different levels of ability to decarbonize across different countries, and it also has different impacts for the development of countries. So it's really important that the responsibilities are perhaps different across the globe, but we will all need to fit within that global carbon budget if we want to hit 1.5 degrees of warming.
How is the United Kingdom doing in meeting its climate change commitments?
We have the Climate Change Committee in the UK, a group of independent advisors that advise the government on policy around climate change. They do a progress report every year. What that repeatedly says is that there's a gap between our ambition and our delivery. And in the run-up to COP in Glasgow, we're finding that the ambition in the UK keeps being ratcheted up. So, you know, we moved to a net zero target rather than 80% by 2050. We've signed up to the 63% target by 2035. But that still leaves this gap in delivery. It's that delivery part that's so important rather than the kind of big headline targets. How are we actually doing that? For policymakers, I think it is really about this being embedded across everything that we do. This is such a fundamental transition. You know, fossil fuels are so interwoven in our lives at the moment that we really cannot overstate how big a transformation this is. So therefore, it has to be part of every decision. So it's not about one bit of government doing some shiny green stuff. It's about every single decision that government makes being compatible with net zero. There's not enough carbon budget to do some stuff that makes it harder and expect somewhere else to kind of catch that up.
Well, let's apply what you've just said to a concrete situation, which is the government's just published its transport decarbonisation policy and immediately being criticised because it suggests we can carry on flying because we'll set it off against other things and anyway, we're going to get cleaner technology. Is that an example of what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think that was a very disappointing part of the strategy, to be honest. Demand for aviation is very skewed in the UK. So 70% of flights are taken by 15% of the population. Half of the population don't fly at all in any given year. The only way to make those reductions in the near term is to think about controlling demand in some way. And so to come out with a kind of headline message that technology will sort this out, we can just carry on as we are, I think does undermine the sense that actually we need to use all the levers that we have. And some of those are demand, some of those are supply. But in aviation in particular, I feel like there's a real opportunity to target very frequent flyers who could kind of half the amount that they're flying, still be flying a lot more than most people and really have an impact on that sector's level of carbon emissions. I suppose what this time in the pandemic has also shown us is that there's lots of ways we could reduce our travel. So adopting that a bit more, trying to get people to just really think about when they fly, is it really worth the emissions? Could I reduce the amount that I fly and have some really impactful trips, whether that's for your, you know, personal impact or work impact, but not just reassembling our practice in exactly the way that it was before the pandemic?
Are we already in a situation where the problem is too great for us to deal with?
Well, it's a funny question because I think we don't have a choice but to deal with it. We've already got a level of climate change baked in from our previous emissions. So we have to make sure that our systems are much more resilient to those kinds of extreme heats and floods and things that we've been seeing. The future level of that is going to be determined by how much we emit in the intervening period. Perhaps in the past, climate change has been separated out too much into mitigation, where we're reducing emissions, and adaptation, where we're adapting to the changes in climate that we have. And actually, we have to do both. So we have to make our systems more resilient and lower carbon, because there are changes in climate already baked in.
Carly McLachlan, there's one phrase that's become almost common parlance nowadays, net zero. Over 100 countries, including the UK, have committed themselves to reach net zero greenhouse emissions, or to put it another way, to be carbon neutral by 2050. But there's some unease in the climate science community about net zero. To discuss why, I'm joined in the briefing room by Dr. James Dyke of Exeter University. James Dyke, can we just clear something up? What does net zero actually mean?
Net zero is conceptually very simple. It means that we will stop our dangerous interference on the climate system when we stop emitting greenhouse gases. And we're going to stop emitting greenhouse gases when we stop burning coal, oil and gas. But some people have reasoned, as well as us being able to put carbon into the Earth's atmosphere through the burning of fossil fuels, we might also be able to remove it at scale through a whole series of processes, which could be relatively low tech, like planting trees, which as they grow, they absorb carbon dioxide from the Earth's atmosphere, to very advanced sort of direct air capture machines, which offer the promise of stripping out carbon dioxide and then storing it safely underground for many thousands of years.
Can we get to net zero? Is this actually an achievable prospect?
We will get to net zero eventually. The question then becomes, at what level of temperature will we reach net zero? For example, if we just keep on with business as usual, with burning all the fossil fuels we can get our hands on, then by the end of this century, the global average temperature would have probably increased by 4 or maybe even beyond 5 degrees Celsius. And then we'll probably see the collapse of our industrial globalized civilization. We won't be able to emit carbon dioxide anymore, and then we will reach net zero that way. Of course, we want to avoid these very scary dystopian futures. And so what the international community has decided is that we will try and get to net zero by around about the middle of this century, because if we do it in the next 30 years or so, there is still enough carbon budget left for us to limit warming to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius.
One of the things, attentions, which seems to be built into discussions about how we do whatever it is we can do to mitigate emissions is on the roles of technologies. You mentioned technologies to sequester carbon, take it out of the air. How are those going? How much reliance should we and could we place upon them?
I can't be very optimistic, I'm afraid. And I base that on the assessment of what has happened over the last 30 years. So back in 1992, when the international community convened its first large kind of big climate conference, there was all this understanding that we need to rapidly reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And at the time, we thought we could do that through energy switching from going from coal to gas, because you will produce much less carbon dioxide burning gas than you would coal. Well, within about 5 years, it looked as if that wasn't going to be sufficient. So then we thought of other ways. So then the first use of the expression offsetting appeared, where we might be able to continue to burn fossil fuels, but then we'll offset that by habitat restoration, maybe some planting some trees. Given another 5 years and the never-ending increase in global carbon emissions, another idea was needed. So by the time you get to the Paris conference 2015 and the very ambitious attempt to try to limit warming to no more than 1.5, there needs to be a whole suite of new technological innovations that would remove carbon dioxide. And that is best captured in this rather wonkish kind of expression of bioenergy carbon capture and storage, which is a kind of blend of bioenergy and carbon capture and sequestration. And even that looks like it's not working, because in order to plant as many trees as you would need in order to power the global economy, it would have a devastating impact on food security, water security, displaced indigenous peoples. And so we're going to the next technological savior.
Sorry, can I stop you there? Is that because you simply would have to plant so many trees that none of those other things could happen?
You would need to plant trees over something like the surface area that would be equivalent to twice the land area of India. But also, I mean, look, rather than planting trees, we should stop chopping them down. You know, the Amazon rainforest is still being destroyed at an alarming rate. We're still deforesting rainforests in Africa, Southeast Asia. And some of that deforestation is being directly linked with bioenergy. For example, the production of palm oil in Southeast Asia in order to supply biofuels for European vehicles.
Do you think net zero is a useful term for us to use?
Net zero had its place. Certainly, if you want to limit warming to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, given how much carbon we have emitted, then the only way that we could possibly get there at this stage is with large-scale removal of carbon dioxide sometime within the next few decades. Unfortunately, in practice, what net zero has done, it's licensed a reckless burn now, pay later approach, in which we are allowing politicians to say, on the one hand, yes, don't worry, the Paris Agreement is still in play. We will limit warming to no more than 1.5, but at the same time do absolutely nothing with regards to the required cuts in fossil fuel use. So in that respect, it's been terribly misused. It has been abused by governments and also some corporations.
What in your mind is the most likely scenario at the moment when it comes to global temperature increases? What is it you think we will be facing in terms of temperature increases?
There's an awful lot of promises and pledges, but we still have yet to see any sufficient action materialise. We are still firmly on track for something around 3 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. In order for there to be anything like limiting warming to no more than 1.5, there would have to be really quite radical, I mean, transformative actions at a national, regional and global level. And there's still no prospect whatsoever that's going to happen. So I do take issue when politicians argue that something like COP26 later this year is the last best chance we have of keeping 1.5 alive. You know, the last best chance was years ago, probably decades ago, given the way in which we conduct climate policy.
You don't think we're going to be galvanised by things like what's happened in the Pacific Northwest of America this year, what's been happening in the floods in Europe this year, and what's been happening in the floods in China this year?
We've been here before, but maybe something is importantly different. So back in 2003, a heat wave killed tens of thousands of people in Europe. I mean, estimates might be up to about 70,000 premature deaths as a consequence of a heat wave that ravaged Europe that year. And there were other lethal heat waves since. What's different now, I think, is that these extreme weather events, they're happening in different regions of the planet. They are showing us this is what climate breakdown looks like. This is what the climate is going to be like with 1.1, 1.2 degrees Celsius of warming. Often climate change was posed as a problem that's going to be affecting our grandchildren or future generations. It's a problem that's here now, and every extra ton of greenhouse gases that we emit makes that problem much harder to address. So maybe in that respect, we can finally see politicians, economists, you know, broadcast media finally joining the dots and understanding what climate change really does mean.
James Dyke. And I think we just have to hope that he's right, that the penny is properly dropping. My thanks to him, Alina Avachenkova, Michael Jacobs and Carly McLachlan. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Kirsty Knight and Sally Abrahams. The sound was mixed by James Beard and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Last week, we examined the lifting of COVID restrictions and what disease modelling can and cannot tell us. We've looked at the changing political demography of the country, and we've asked, what does Hamas want?
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about
quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.